My son-in-law preaches down in New Madrid, Missouri, and at a little church called Lilburn, and I was getting ready to preach there one Sunday for him, and he came up and put a phone or something right in front of me and pushed record, and I said, man, if I wasn't already nervous enough, he had to do that, so thanks, Jeff. But first I want to thank everybody for this opportunity to come down here, and I know when you have a very small congregation, it's kind of a burden when somebody's gone, and I know Ray Warfel and Cheryl comes up there quite often to Sioux City and helps us out. And Alan and Leah's been coming up there. And I know it's kind of a burden for you guys when they're gone. And I did make sure that Ray was going up there before I committed to coming down here. So I do want to thank you for putting up with that. And I got thinking, it's such a... As we're sitting there singing, I didn't know one of the Edwards was here. I thought you looked familiar to me, but here I... appreciate so much Ray and Alan coming up there, because you got people that's good teachers, good speakers, and that. And then I'm coming down here, and then you got a visitor from Indiana that's probably as good as they get, and then you got to listen to me. So if you're if you was expecting, and by the way, Keith Beeman's probably one of my best friends. So if you're wondering, I was out there for Andrew's graduation, and I met you then. But anyway, if you're expecting to hear a really good emotional speaker, you know, one of them guys that can just raise the roof off, that's not me. I'm just a farmer and a cattle feeder from northeast Nebraska. But I really love Jesus, and I love the church and things, and I got some things in my heart that I love, telling people. So as we get into this, I hope, I can maybe make you laugh once or twice, and hopefully I don't make you cry. Usually people cry before I get done with my sermons, so... I'll try not to do that, but hopefully at the end there's a good message where you maybe feel good, or maybe want you to get out and do something is what I'm hoping here. But anyway, has anybody ever tried to do something and failed? I think about our neighbor across the road. He's an old man, and he's been passed away for years, but he was always inventing stuff, building stuff. And I remember as a kid down there once, his nickname was Buck. I said, man, Buck, you build so many things. It's just so interesting what you can do in that. And he said, go walk through my trees, you can see all my failures. You build something, didn't work, you throw it out in his trees and start on something different. And, we all fail at things in our life, whether it's in your jobs. Sometimes you'll make a mistake, you'll fail. Or at school, you might fail a test. Or, they're just sports, there's failures all the time. And failure is a very common thing. I just got a list of a few here. To Albert Einstein, I guess when he was 16 years old, he took an entrance exam into a really prestigious university and he failed. But then we know his history. He went on to be one of the greatest in mathematics and physics there was. And Michael Jordan, we've all heard about him. His freshman year, he got cut from the basketball team. And he went on to be maybe one of the greatest ever. And Henry Ford, his first two companies he started, they went bankrupt and failed. And I always tell Keith, I said, it's a good thing that Ford wasn't one of his first, or we'd all be stuck driving Chevys all the time. So, because Keith, he drives Chevys, and Dave does. But Henry Ford had a great quote, and this is something you can really think about this in your life when you become a Christian, starting over. But he said, failure is simply the opportunity to begin again, this time more intelligently. So a lot of times failures isn't always that bad. But has there ever been any failures in the Bible? I got a list in my notes here. I put the bad guys, failures, and I had Genesis 11 read there in the Tower of Babel. They had these people moving across this plain and come across this great area, and they wanted to build this great big grand city, and they wanted to build a tower to heaven so they could make a name for themselves. They could be better than anybody around. Well, God put them in their place when he confused their language and sent them on. The one I kind of get a kick out of is in 1 Kings chapter 18, when the prophets were arguing over whose prophet was a real prophet, whose God or whose prophet wasn't. And so Elijah had this challenge with them about, let's build this altar, let's put this cow on it and do all these things. And the false prophets of Baal, they were running and leaping and cutting themselves, and they were doing everything they could to get their God to send down fire, and it just never happened. That was quite a failure. Or Nebuchadnezzar in Daniel 4, the wise man, trying to interpret them dreams, he called all the wise men from the whole kingdom, I think, to come there to interpret the dreams, and nobody could interpret the dreams. So, they failed at what they was trying to do. But does any of the good guys of the Bible ever fail? And these aren't big failures, but in Matthew 17, when a man brought his demon-possessed son to Jesus, said, your disciples, they couldn't get this demon out of our son. What was going on? And So Jesus had to explain to them, you know, there's a way to do it, which there might be more to it than just the fasting and prayer. But, you know, they failed at removing that demon. Or in Luke 5, verse chapter 5, verse 5, you know, these guys, they fished all night long and never caught a fish. And, of course, I got to rub Keith and Dave on that a little bit. You know, I don't know what it's like to not catch fish, but they do. I always bring that up to them, go fish and never catch anything. But, you know, they fished all night and never caught a thing. And then, you know, they were told how to do it. And they went out and caught a whole bunch. Or what about Jesus? Did he fail? You know, we know the rest of the story. We know he didn't. But in that first century, you know, when they hung him up on the cross and he died and he was buried in the ground, their perceptions was he failed. It's over. You remember they all left. They went back to their homes and went back to their jobs. And they started, I mean, they did end up in Jerusalem for that, you know, they told was told to go there and wait. But they kind of thought Jesus failed at that time, that this they've been following this guy for 3.5 years, give everything they had. And all of a sudden, he's dead and gone. You know, what a deal. Did he fail? And yeah, that kind of gets me to thinking about, and I heard a sermon on the radio kind of inspired me to write this one time. And I don't know if this is all completely true, but, you know, what about the Christians that was in Rome in about 64 A.D. when Nero burned the city? They blamed the Christians. He was going from door to door. He was killing every Christian he could find. He was trying to get rid of them Christians, just kill every one of them. And this story on the radio said there were six families, so I have no, or six people, three families. I have no idea if that's true or not, but this guy, that's what he claimed. And I'll get back to this later, but that was left, and they were hiding in a little house from Nero so they wouldn't be killed. And they were the last ones in Rome the way this went. And, you know, they're thinking that we've all failed. And, you know, it makes me think of Gamaliel in chapter 5, verse 35, if his words were ringing through their head, if they would have heard him about, you know, when Peter and a bunch of disciples were thrown in prison and they wanted to kill him, actually wanted to kill him. And this Gamaliel said, you know, just hold off here a minute, because not too many years ago, I think it was Thaddeus, was a guy who rose up a bunch of men. And when he died, it kind of went away. And then after that, another guy rose up, had a bunch of followers. And when he died, it kind of ended. And then Gamaliel kind of said, you know, if this work is of man, it won't amount to nothing. But if it's from God, we can't overthrow it anyway. You know, you see, one of these families that was left in Rome, maybe was thinking about that, thinking that, you know, maybe this Jesus did fail. And so just imagine if you could be there and you got these six people hiding in this house, dark, and you could go in this house to them six people and say, you know, it ain't going to be very many years from now. There's going to be crosses all over Rome. And not just little wooden crosses everywhere. There are going to be crosses that's built up in the architectures of buildings. I mean, they're going to be built in. There's going to be crosses everywhere. And about 300 years from now, about 380 AD, I think, when the official date was, that Christianity actually became the official religion of Rome. Could you imagine them six people left in there hearing that, thinking, you are crazy. We're going to be lucky to live, let alone, you mean Christianity is going to be, you just about imagine if that's true about them six people. They think they're crazy, but you think about that. The people of the first century, they changed the world. And that gets me to thinking all the time, what are we doing? Are we changing the world? I just think about, well, we'll get to that. But what are we doing? And then how did all this start? So in Matthew chapter 5, that's where I spend probably most of my time this morning. How did the people in the first century change the world? What was done that made them have so much confidence? But Jesus, one of his first sermons that he ever gave, and you know, we call it the Sermon on the Mount, and here in Matthew chapter 5, it says, well, the last verse 4, it says, great multitudes followed him from Galilee and from Decapolis, Jerusalem, Judea, and from beyond the Jordan. And seeing the multitudes, he went up on a mountain, and when he was seated, his disciples came to him. Well, I'm not sure if it was just his disciples he's speaking to here or the whole multitude. If you go over to Luke, I think it's chapter 6, kind of implies that he was speaking to the whole multitude. So it really don't matter. He was speaking to a large group of people here. And you got to remember, most of these were Jews at this time that was following him. I don't know if there was any Gentiles at all. Hard to believe there wouldn't have been a few, but mostly Jews he was speaking to. You know, so he started this sermon when he opened up his mouth. He said, blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. And blessed are those who mourn, For they shall be comforted, and blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. Them words alone to a Jew would be sitting there thinking, now usually the guy who has the biggest sword's got the most power, and here you're telling us to be poor in spirit, mourn, and meek. You know, you could almost kind of put yourself in their position and think that, I don't know if, you know, really what he's talking about there. And in the verse 6, blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they shall be filled. Blessed are the merciful, for they shall obtain mercy. And blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. You know, most Jews would probably be sitting there thinking, well, that's probably, I can go along with that, agree with that. And in verse 9, blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called sons of God. Well, the last time Israel and the Jews was really a great nation, David was their king, and David was a man of war. He wasn't a peacemaker. So that would have been a little contrary to what their thinking was at that time. He wants us to be peacemakers. Now we want to take up our swords. We want to be a great nation like it was back when David was there. So there's some things that probably wasn't really fitting with them real well. And in verse 10, blessed are those who are persecuted for righteous sake, and for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are you when you revile and persecute, or when they revile and persecute you and say all kinds of evil against you falsely for my sake. Rejoice and exceedingly glad, for the great is your reward in heaven, for so they persecuted the prophets who were before you. They had to be sitting there thinking, you're wanting us to fight. You're telling us that it's going to be good to be persecuted, it's going to be good to have all these terrible things be speaking against, and you're wanting us to follow you. This is Jesus' first recorded sermon, as far as I know, if things are chronological here a little bit. So they had to be sitting there thinking, and Jesus probably looking out, seeing the looks on their faces, maybe was thinking that, you know, they aren't getting what I'm saying here. So Jesus was going to tell them not how to act, but how they need to be. Because the next verse, he says, you are the salt of the earth, but if the salt loses its flavor, how shall it be seasoned? It is then good for nothing but to be thrown out and trampled underfoot by men. So Jesus is telling them, you need to be salt. You know what salt actually is? Salt is actually a preservative. You know, I know we put it on our food and it makes it taste a lot better. On my steak, I just love a lot of salt. I mean, I just cover it with salt, and I love that. But salt is actually a preservative. And so in a sense here, Jesus is telling them, you guys need to preserve what's good. Preserve things. And then he goes on to say, you are the light of the world. How many people you know their attitude is, I don't want to be salt, I don't want to be light, I just want to go to church, and I want to go to heaven and leave me alone. You ever run into them that all they want to do is go to church and go to heaven and be done? They don't want to be salt, light. And you know what the thing is? Salt always preserves. You can't put salt on something and not preserve it. And light always lights. You ever see how hard it is to cover up light? You know, you can be in a pitch black dark room, take a little speck of a light, and it'll light up a lot. I mean, it takes a lot of work to cover it. And it was interesting, last night at the football game, I've never seen that before, at the start of the fourth quarter, everybody turned on their cell phone flashlights around the stadium. And that was a very neat sight at night, where it was dark. But no matter, light or salt always preserves, and light always lights. So what are we supposed to be preserving? And what are we supposed to be light? You know, and to go through the rest of the chapter, I'm going to go through these kind of quick, or the rest of his sermon here. But in verse 22, I'm going to paraphrase these just a little bit too. But in verse 22, it says, don't be angry. Verse 28, don't look at a woman with lust. Verse 32, don't divorce for any other reason but adultery. Verse 37 is basically tell the truth. And verse 39, turn the other cheek. Verse 42, be generous. Verse 44, you love your enemy. And in chapter 6, verse 1, you're supposed to be humble and modest, you know, given to prayer and fasting. Verse 14, forgiving. Verse 20, lay up treasure in heaven. Verse 25 through 34, be content, don't worry. Chapter 7, verses 1 through 5, talks about judging cautiously and righteous, basically. And verse 15, beware of false prophets. Verse 16 through 20, bear good fruit. And verse 24, those that hears these sayings of mine and does them is like a wise man. So there is a lot of things within this whole sermon, and I know I touched on them really quickly, that are things that a Christian, if you profess to be a Christian, you can't help but be in salt and light to the world. And these are the things that you're supposed to preserve, this good teaching that was here. But as far as individuals, but even as a congregation, you know, your collective group here, you need to be salt and light also to the community. It isn't just an individual thing, which largely it is, but it's also a congregational thing about changing the world. And then I got in my notes here, I put as a question, are you guys, look at yourself individually and as a group, are you changing the world as an individual? And even the young people in here, and even the older people, there's no exceptions to that. You need to be doing something to change the world. And there's more back in Matthew chapter 5, back in verse 4, chapter 5, verse 14, where it talks about you're a light. There's more in that. It said, a city that is set on a hill cannot be hidden. You know, that set there means placed. And there's reasons for everything. You know, even Stephen, when he was killed, Paul, if you were studying Acts, pretty, it's going to take a lot forever to get through it, but pretty in depth. And it's amazing. And Paul's teaching is a lot of the things that Paul says kind of almost reminds you of something that Stephen would have said. And maybe Stephen was martyred and killed in front of Paul to have an influence on Paul the rest of his life. You think about that. A man lost his life. It might have changed Paul's life once Paul realized, you know, a few days after that. You know, every one of you here had somebody that was light or salt that influenced you to be here, whether it's a parent, a friend, co-worker, or someone. Every one of you guys had salt or light that influenced you. And, you know, so often you question, why am I here? Why does so-and-so here? And I got a list of things that just almost unexplainable, you know, the way things happen. And we had a man from Tennessee showed up, started worshiping for Jeff Patterson. And he started coming right before our only song leader passed away. And Jeff was a song leader. You know, how's that happen? And, you know, in our little church up in Sioux City has been through a lot, it seems like. But we've had a couple of really nasty splits. And back, I didn't put the year down, but a family from Athens, Alabama, I think it was. It wasn't Georgia. But they come and stayed, worshiped with us one whole summer. And it was an older couple, very grounded, very solid, that really helped us through when this split happened. It was kind of a bad deal. And then had another guy from Tennessee that spent over a year and a half up there with us. About the time we were dealing with some pretty bad sin in the congregation, we had to remove a preacher, and he was there. And it just, at times when it just feels like you just can't do it no more, somebody shows up that keeps you going. And it just, how's that happen? But the one that really gets me was, most of you know that here, I guess it had been almost 2 years ago in December, our preacher had been working for a year to get us to merge with the liberal congregation across town. That actually went on for over a year. And the whole time, we were thinking he was working with them, trying to teach them the truth about, you know, the Christianity, that not the liberal church. Well, it kind of come out right at the end. He'd been working on us the whole time to get us to basically turn liberal and go with them. So we basically fired him that next week, and he resigned at the end of the year. But anyway, the very next Sunday, we had a visitor from Kentucky, and she walked in. This is the very next Sunday. She walked in, her and her husband, everybody, and she said, "How's things going here?" I said, "Well, okay, you know, we're still going, you know." Just, I didn't want to say a word about it. She said, "Well, I've been worried about you for a year." And I said, "Well, why is that?" She said, "Well, I visited here last year for Christmas. And she said, your preacher is talking about a lesson about merging with the other congregation and getting along and all this and that." She said, "I've been worried about you for a year." Well, that opened the door up. And so I told her what was going on. And she said, "Well, you just hang in there. You're doing the right thing." And you think about when you're down there, when there's a nasty split, you can't help but think, man, am I right or wrong? You know, just deep down, you know you're right, but you're just not sure. Well, them words from her that next Sunday, that's being placed on a hill. You know, she, that just gives you so much confidence. How'd that happen the very next Sunday that after we fired him, she was there and did that? But anyway, every one of you guys have opportunities and places. You're placed in places. You don't even know why you're there, or somebody's, all of a sudden somebody pops in your life. there's a reason for it, and it'll be for good if you can search for it and find it. But every one of us has had, otherwise you wouldn't be here, the salt and the light. But anyway, one of our greatest failures is when we sin. You know, we fall short. That's a failure. You know, that separates us from the Lord. And luckily, God has given us an avenue through the, and I'm sure you've all heard the lessons about the faith, repentance, confession, baptism, and, you know, living a righteous life. But we all have the opportunity to fix that. As Henry Ford said, to live life more intelligently afterwards. Once you failed, you have a chance to get that fixed and then live more intelligently. And so as I wrap this lesson up, think about that separation, that sin. But I want to go back just for a minute here, and we're just about done. I'm known for my short sermons. I don't like boring people, but them six people that when I first become a Christian, there in Sioux City, we had Glenn and Shirley and Ed and Barb and Kathy and I. There were six of us. And that's why when I heard that sermon on the radio, it struck me so hard. I knew what that was like. You know, like you're hiding in a dark room. You don't want to, you know, I don't want to say you're ashamed, but, you know, even like now our singing is like scratching fingernails across a chalkboard. As I say, yeah, how do you get anybody excited about church and wanting to come in and be a part of your group when there's six people and four of them is old? And, you know, just when I heard that on the radio, that really struck me about, there's that number six people there. But, you know, what if we fail being the salt and light to people? How many churches do you know around the country that their doors are no longer open? I bet there's quite a few, if you think, especially the preachers. There's a lot of churches. And we were eating at Valentino's yesterday, and Sue from the Lincoln Church works there. Have run into her. Well, she told me the news that they're down to their last week or two, and they're shutting their doors. That's pretty tough. And I know just north of Terre Haute, there's a little church, I think, is at Harmony. Is that the one south where Nicholas and the Hathaways go preach quite a bit? They're very small, aren't they? And I know I've worshipped there one time with them, but, you know, it ain't be long till their doors shut. And then I get to thinking they got all, I just actually, literally just as before I walked up there, I had this thought in my mind. Here they got, Harmony's got all these preachers going to help them, trying to keep their doors open. I just thought, man, that's what's going on in Sioux City. We got Alan and Ray's coming up just trying to help keep our doors open. But how long is it going to be to where maybe these doors shut for the last time? Is it going to be a generation? Is it going to be a year, 10 years? You know, at what point? And all I want, the whole deal of this lesson, I just wanted to bring back is there's, and I know Alan and I talked about this, about, I think it was Ben, my son-in-law, what a lot of the other churches, denominations, and other religions, call them, do way better than us as Christians. And one of them is evangelizing. You know, I've got Mormons and Jehovah's coming to my door all the time, you know, and usually once I start talking the Bible, they get out of there just quick as they can. But, you know, we need to work harder to grow churches, evangelize on an individual level. You know, it ain't, I know up there we've tried to put ads in papers and things, but that ain't very personal. You know, that's, but, and Thomas Edison had a great quote. He said, "I have not failed. I have succeeded in finding 10,000 ways that don't work." So when you're evangelizing, you need to try to find 10,000 ways that don't work. I guess that's the simplest way to put it. But I just, you know, I've not been a Christian for a long, very long, maybe 20 years or something. And I've seen so many churches that's just getting smaller and smaller and smaller. And eventually there ain't going to be any left. And at some point, somebody has to do something to change the world. Like, you think of them in the first century, under the oppression that they had, they changed the world. We've got it easy nowadays. We could change the world, but we just need to get busy. But if there's anybody subject to the invitation, you know, that's failed in sin or has not become a Christian yet, and you just can't take it anymore, you know that sin's weighing you down, and there just comes a point in your life where you can't take it anymore. You have to do something about it. you know, today can be the day, or if there's anybody that just needs prayers for the congregation and help, that's who we are. We're just a big family. You know, that's one of the great things about the church. You know, no matter where you go in the country, you'll usually find somebody that you know, somebody that knows somebody, and pretty soon you're friends, and like you've known each other forever. So maybe if there's anybody subject to the invitation, come forward as we stand and sing.